You're listening to The Sweeper, the pan-European football podcast that brings you all the news from the 55 UEFA nations and sometimes a little bit beyond.
On this episode of The Sweeper, we get the full lowdown on the Kuyi Klaksvik European miracle from Daniel Storey, relive our trip to Czechia to see the team that lost 9-5, and chat about more quirks of the Liechtenstein Cup. Hello and welcome to the Sweeper podcast. My name is Lee Wingate and I'm joined in the virtual studio for this one by my usual co-host Paul Watson and a special guest who has spent the last week in the Faroe Islands getting the inside story on Kuyi Klaksvik, who picked up the country's first ever European group stage win over Olimpia Ljubljana. Daniel Storey is the chief football writer at The Eye and a regular panelist on the Totally Football Show. Daniel, a very warm welcome to the Sweeper.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Kuyi Klaksvik have been on our radar for a while. They've broken a series of Faroese records over the past season. And then this summer, they've beaten the champions of Sweden, Hungary, Norway, now Slovenia too. How did you first become aware of them and what motivated you to spend a week there?
I mean, I know I'm amongst friends here. I like niche football stories. I like getting away from the Premier League, which is what my day job is most of the time, to finding out kind of these untold stories or lesser told, and also fascinated by the Faroes. And I think I grew up in Nottingham, so kind of islands in general. I really like this idea of island life, so I've wanted to go there for a long time. So when the draw was made, and they were, you know, when they made that Conference League draw by beating Häcken, immediately it kind of went onto the shortlist, and I nagged away at bosses and tried to persuade them that I could get a couple of long reads out of it, one about Kuyi and one about Faroese football in general, which I'll do next month. And like Kuyi themselves, I circled the Olimpia Ljubljana home game as the most likely to win. And then they went and drew against Lille, which was a little bit of a blow, because I kind of thought if they then lose 3-0 at home to Olimpia Ljubljana, the piece is not quite what I want it to be. But cross my fingers and should never have doubted them, because as you said, they beat Olimpia, they won 3-0. It was a brilliant performance. It was bizarrely comfortable from the first goal onwards, and on they march.
So talk about the game. One of the things that really struck me was the reaction from the fans for this 3-0. So you're saying, to some degree, you saw this coming, right? That's why you were there. I think you had an inkling this could happen. But it seems to me like, despite all these heroics this year, the fans were basically in disbelief, were they not, about what had happened?
Yeah, absolutely. I spoke to Magne Hoseth, the Norwegian manager, before the game, and I think he, as an outsider and doing the job he does, was pretty clear that, you know, he said, my team talk is going to have to be different tomorrow. This is the one we can win. I believe that. And he needed to get across to his players that they've been playing very much, you know, sacrificing possession, playing counter-attacking football, which is not what they do in the domestic league because they're so dominant. And he needed to get across that the whole system needed to change. Everybody else he spoke to in the club, Thomas Lervig, the chairman, Solbjana, Kristian Dottir, who's a kind of media officer and supporter, they are still in that mindset of, we can't believe this is happening and we're all just pinching ourselves. The only slight difference to that was the guy who is the head of the Blue Wave fan group. They're kind of very, very small set of ultras that go behind the goal with the drum. And he said, I believe tomorrow night for the first time, because I think the draw against Lille has convinced a few of the players that they're better than they thought they were. Playing in the Faroe Islands, I suspect, can be a very insular experience, and it can be quite hard to judge yourself. I think that was the first time that they realised. And they also know the advantages of playing at home on the, you know, on the non-turf surface when it's freezing cold and it was windy and it was rainy, and all those elements turned up on Thursday as well.
What about the start to the game then? Because Olimpia Ljubljana were on the front foot in the sort of opening minutes, but it seemed like Kuyi really sort of came into it around the midway point of the first half. What was it like watching them? What is their style of play like?
In Europe, they do sacrifice possession. They invite the opposition teams onto them. They use the wingers on the counter-attack while the striker stays pretty high up the pitch. But everyone else is behind the ball. And you're right, they started slowly. If Olympia had scored at that point, then I think the game would have been very different. But yeah, I call it a mini miracle. And the reason is not just because of the resource gap here. It's also because everything in every moment seems to have completely gone their way. You know, they don't beat Ferencvaros unless they get that early penalty. I don't think they beat Olympia unless they score first and score against the run of play and then a score just before half time again to take a 2-0 lead. Everything just seems to have fallen into place. And even Magna Hoseth, who is he's very much a pragmatist. He's a straight talking guy. He accepts there's this element of, you know, I went into the dressing room at half time at Ferencvaros and was, you know, I didn't really know what to say because everything I'd planned for didn't happen. We scored goals. We played on the attack. We countered at teams that are far better than us. Olympia are not a great side, I don't think. Their players didn't really look, as soon as they went a goal down, that they felt that they could get back into the game. It isn't a particularly nice place to play football, Faroes, if you're from a country, albeit, you know, Slovenia is not a tropical island, let's be clear. But yeah, it wasn't a particularly nice night for football to chase a game. But it just feels like all of their opponents get kind of sucked into this narrative of we're playing against something that even our opposition can't really control.
Yeah. So you mentioned the resources gap, and this was something that jumped out at me in your article, was that we've been talking a lot in this European run about what this might change for KOA and what they might be able to do with the money that will come in now. And one of the things that came up time and time again is, well, they can professionalize their players, which is obviously a big part of the romance of this story is, you know, you've got your warehouse operatives, you've got your whatever, your electricians. But one thing that really jumped out at me was that you were saying some of the players have specifically said they wouldn't want to go professional, which goes against a narrative that we are so programmed to believe, I think, in the UK, certainly.
Yeah, and I think our view is shared by, to an extent, by Magna, the manager. He was very clear immediately after the Ferenc game. They spoke to several players who are part-time, including some of the starters on Thursday night. This is not just fringe players we're talking about. And gave them the opportunity to be bought out of their day job. And they said, no, we quite like it, thanks. There is certainly something about Faroese life, and it probably applies to Klaksvík more than any other place I went to in the, you know, on the islands, where you work for what you get. It's a survival life. You know, weather is pretty tough for 3 months of the year. You're reliant upon the fishing industry. You're reliant upon looking after each other. The towns kind of work as this cooperative unit and everyone looks after each other because it is only a town of 5,000 people. And they seriously think, well, we'd be letting down, you know, there's not a huge stream of potential employees for these companies. They think, well, we'd be letting down the company that's been giving us time off to train and been letting us leave early for games. And I know those people, not just as colleagues, but also as friends, because it's such a tiny town. The head of the Blue Wave group was at pains to say, we're a fan group, but we're not really a fan group because these are our mates as well. You know, we can hug them. We can ask them out to dinner. This is not a situation of footballers and fans. This is just a kind of members of the town all in it together. And I think the players honestly feel like that. And the other thing to say is that might change over time. This is their first European season. This is their first taste of this. KOA, I think at the moment, are going to on track to earn about €4 million from their participation if all goes as planned. And that's a huge amount of money to the town. And that may change. But right now, they're happy. Yeah, the really funny thing is that Magna was saying the frustrations of coaching this team. He's obviously done his courses. He's doing his pro license at the moment. And he was saying, everything I've learned I had to rip up because your UEFA licenses don't teach you how to create a training program for an electrician that's been on his knees all day, or for a guy who's been up and down ladders fixing stuff, or a guy who's been just stood on his feet for 10 hours in a fish farm. So he's had to change everything. It makes it all very unique. And he believes genuinely, and this sounds like, you know, it sounds like a whimsy, but he believes that makes them very hard to scout. It makes them very hard to deal with as an opponent because you really don't know what you are getting from these players. You don't know how hard they've worked. You don't know how ready they are. And the miraculous achievement of all this is that for every game, they have been absolutely on it. If not from the first minute, then certainly from the first big moment of every game.
how far do you trust that they can go then? Because one of the recurring themes in your piece was this: every time they come up against an obstacle, they somehow seem to get past it. So is qualification from the group a realistic possibility, do you think?
I certainly feel more convinced than I did before Thursday night. Slovan Bratislava should be too strong for them. Lille obviously should be. Lille played a reserve team in that fixture and then brought on first team players when it became clear it wasn't going to be as easy as they felt. And by the way, didn't even have a shot on target against Klaksvík, which is mad. So I think they will lose the away leg or the away tie-in for that one. Slovan will be better than Olympia. I think they can win away in Ljubljana, which would be, you know, tick off another first, would be the first away win for any Faroese team in a European group stage. And if they do that, it will bring a huge amount on that Slovan Bratislava home game, because that's then the group, I think. My gut is that they'll finish third in that group, and that's still an extraordinary achievement, obviously. The question is about how this recycles for next season and under new managers as well, because I don't think there's any secret that Magna is there to as his first managerial job. He's doing his pro license in Oslo now alongside this job. And, you know, the last manager who we may talk about, Mikael Thomasson, has already got a job in Fredrikstad and then taken that team in Norway up into the top flight. So there is an element of regeneration that has to happen here. And that's my only question is, are they going to get everything right to allow this thing continue?
Yeah, a question that I had actually that popped up is, of course, it was the end of the season for the Faroe Islands at the weekend, which actually, I believe, Køge lost again to Vikingur, the only other team that beat them this season, I think. How much their mind must be on that, given the title is already theirs. But do you get a sense from the players that this will be an advantage or a disadvantage, that suddenly they won't actually have any games now between their European outings?
Yeah, I think they see it as an advantage. I don't think that's just them parroting a party line. I think that is true. Hurt Magna said that the big issue he's had is that they've never played midweek games before, basically. The Faroese League is played at weekends and they haven't had European games very often, which means they've basically not been training because they are part semi-pro in the large. They've not had a full squad at training at all because they're just, you know, you have to let semi-professional players relax if they're playing twice a week. So he's been using the league games as training sessions, particularly against the lower half teams. And there is a big gap between them and those lower half teams. So he's been playing different systems or trying different things out. And he said that's been hard. Now we'll probably feel more like normal in that they'll be at one game a week. It just happens to be that the game in the midweek will be against teams in Europe rather than teams, you know, just the other side of a sea tunnel.
To come back to Mikael Thomasson, the former manager, we'd like to ask a little bit about how Køge's recent rise has actually come about. Because you wrote in your piece, this guy said 8 years ago that Køge could be the first Faroese team in the group stages, and everybody laughed at him. But they have done it. So how has it happened?
I mean, that laughter was not misplaced, partly because it was a ludicrous dream at the time, and partly because the Europa Conference League didn't exist at that point, and therefore what he was talking about was Europa League or Champions League, which, let's be frank, would still be a nonsensical achievement. But ostensibly in 2011-12, Køge were close to bankruptcy. There was simply not a system or not enough of a system of local sponsorship to bring in enough money. And they appointed Mikael Thomasson in 2014, after the bankruptcy stage, after companies had agreed to sponsor, and we should say in Faroe Islands terms, Køge are fairly well off. They are very well sponsored by JFK, is the kind of fishing corporation that I went into the local newspaper to speak to the editor, and he wanted to talk about football, but he mainly wanted to talk about the new trawler that had been unveiled the week before by JFK and was the pride of the town, standing as a pillar alongside Køge as the two, you know, the two sides of our community. And he's right to do that. That money has really helped. But Mitchell came in with this dream that they shouldn't just want to try and win the Faroese League, which they hadn't done since 1999, and did eventually under him in 2019, and then in 21 and 22, I think. But yeah, he said we should dream bigger than this. And to do that, we're going to need to put structures in place and have a clarity of dream, not just live for 1 year down the line, but live for 5 and 10 years down the line. And the example that the media officer Solby gave to me was that they had this room downstairs in the new clubhouse and nobody really knew what to do with it. And he said, well, I want you to spend £500,000, which is about £50,000, on getting it revamped and putting in machines so I can measure everybody's physical stats after training and after games. And I mean, that's completely alien to this kind of, I call it a Sunday league culture, and I don't mean that, you know, with any degree of criticism whatsoever. It's purely a descriptor. It is a turn up and play culture. And they think that changed the game. The Faroe Islands is a nation, even though it is obsessed by football, where I suspect you can make very quick wins through not a huge amount of money and not a huge amount of outside the box thinking. And I think that's what Mitchell did. And he was Faroese. That's the surprise in all this, is that they assumed it would take an outsider to come in and push through these. He was a freak of Faroese culture, and he had this outsider mentality from the Faroe Islands. And that's what's led him to, you know, get the job at Fredrikstad and take a couple of the best players with him and get a promotion and do his own kind of mini miracle journey, he would say.
One funny thing that really popped to my mind about this story is obviously it's a fairy tale and there's something really lovely about all of this. But also we've touched upon the fact that Kaoi are not underdogs in the Faroe Islands. They're very much the big dogs. Is there a risk going forwards now that with this huge amount of money that's going to come in and the fact they're already the dominant force, is there a sense there that the league could become a procession now and we might end up with a monopoly going forward with Kaoi obviously only going to get stronger from here, really?
Yes, is the short answer. That is, it's clearly a risk. I wouldn't even say it's a risk. I'd say it's a strong probability. It's something that, you know, I asked of Thomas Lervig, the chairman, and he agreed and he said, yes, you know, you have to understand that we have the ambition to win the league every year, but also we do want domestic competition, because if we're going to go further in Europe, that's only going to help. They are still of the, and this is all very new to them at the moment, they are still of the opinion that what they did was not outside the realms of at least three or four other clubs in that top flight. They think they can be an example to clubs in Tórshavn, in Runavik, to try and mirror this model and to try and grow sustainably, but also, you know, enlarge themselves very, very quickly on the pitch. He thinks they can do that. I'm not so sure about that. I think Kaoi will be, you know, will be pretty dominant for a while. But the other thing to say is that the huge jump in, and I don't know the exact figures here, but the huge jump in UEFA coefficient that the Faroe Islands are going to get, I think will initially provide a boost to other clubs, because if I'm not mistaken, it's potentially going to provide another place in a qualifying round. I think they're ranked about 19th in Europe in terms of domestic leagues, which is bizarre for them. And that's only going to continue as they keep going through this group stage. So that is a potential immediate benefit. I think it's a more longer term thing. They see everything as a kind of aspirational. They're very upbeat. They see it as everybody will want to now beat Kaoi. And that's undoubtedly true. They are everybody's cup final in the league from now on. Maybe that will kind of inspire a different way of thinking, because the facilities in the Faroe Islands, it's not that they've got better facilities than anyone else. It's that they've had, I think, a bit more investment and now have had this huge jump. So, yeah, why can't other teams do that would be their point. But, you know, this is a club of, you know, a town of 5,000 people that has managed to do this. If it makes the Faroese top flight look more attractive to foreign players, if it makes it more likely for investment in academies, all power to them. But the bottom line is that it's a country of 50,000 people. You can't magic up a, you know, I'm going to write a piece for the November international break about them being the most overachieving country in the world by FIFA points. And the reality is that has a ceiling for every club and for the country, because, or the state or the territory, because, yeah, 52,000 people is not enough to sustain. I think it's 7,000 males aged between 19 and 35. That isn't enough to sustain a country that somehow managed to get to 74 in the FIFA World Rankings in 2015. I mean, it's an obscene rise, and it's one that deserves to be told just as much as Kaoi, because that came first.
Yeah, to speak about Faroese football more broadly, how has this massive overachievement happened? You mentioned in your piece for The Eye that there is this open door policy at outdoor football stadiums where people can just simply go in and have a kickabout. What other things are they doing that explains this rise in football nationally, perhaps compared to some of the other smaller countries in Europe?
I think it starts with a mindset of being a territory of Denmark and being immensely and intensely proud of where they come from in terms of their own town and village and the Faroe Islands. There's no animosity towards Denmark, but they are Faroese. That is how they see themselves. And in FIFA and UEFA terms, they are. In Paralympics terms, they are. In Olympic terms, they're not. So there's this kind of weird disparity between what they're told they should be and how they feel. So, you know, they are Danish citizens, but they're not in the EU because Denmark is, but they aren't. They use the Danish krona. But they feel they have this huge identity to be Faroese. I think it starts from that. I think it starts to wanting to be better than they're told. As you mentioned at the start in the piece, they talk about changing reality. And their whole mindset, speaking to the guys at the Football Association, is people will tell us we should be this. So why don't we show them we can be this plus 100? Why don't we show them we can be 10 times better than people expect? I think it comes from that. And within that, they've put a structure in place of investment, not just in football, but in sport, in swimming, in handball. They're massive overachievers in both. But football is the love. So, yeah, they have these, every village, and I'm talking about a village of 600 people, has a 4G pitch that would be, you know, that Nottingham probably doesn't have as good a 4G pitch or doesn't have anything better than they've got in terms of facilities. And yeah, it's open to everybody. Children on a non-match day can literally walk into the National Stadium in Tórshavn and have a kickabout. And there are footballs behind both goals to allow them to do that. And the floodlights will be turned on if there's someone there to enable them to carry on, if there's people still willing to play when the sun goes down, which, you know, in winter is very, very early. And they play long into the night in summer because of, you know, because the light halts. So there is, when I say there's this obsession with football, I think in certainly the UK, we see a football obsession as I really want my team to win, or I go online and look at news for my team every 10 minutes and I follow everything on social media. It's a very different football obsession to that. It's a I want to play, because if you've only got 7,000 men, males aged between 19 and 35, and you've got 44 teams in your organised league structure, if you grow up and have a modicum of talent and want to play, you will probably play in the top two divisions in the Faroe Islands League. And if you play in the top two divisions, you know, you're not miles off being away from the international, the fringes of the international setup. And then you can play Spain and you can play Italy and you can not play England yet, although they'd like to. They haven't ever drawn us before. More than anything, and this sounds a kind of half answer, it's the clarity of position A, the start, which is a kid wanting to play football professionally or for his country, and position B, which is actually doing that. And in England, you've got about a 0.00001% chance of doing it. In the Faroes, if you really want it, you've probably got about a 10% chance of doing it. And I think that having that dream combined with the investment and the structure just creates this vast overachievement. They have been 75 in the world rankings before. They're currently about 120, but it's only San Marino, Liechtenstein and Gibraltar who have smaller populations in UEFA. And they are, you know, in terms of rankings, and I know that's not everything, but they are light years ahead of those three at the moment.
Absolutely fascinating. Where can people read your long read piece that you wrote while in Klaksvík?
I'm the chief football writer for The Eye, so online, inews.co.uk. And then, yeah, as I mentioned, I'm going to do another. Even my editor, as helpful as he was for this piece, agreed that two Faroese pieces in the same week was probably pushing the interest angle slightly. So the one on Faroese football overachievement is going to come out for the November international break, I think.
It's a brilliant piece, by the way. It's annoyingly good. It's one of those ones I wish I'd written. It's so good.
Cheers. Thank you.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciated having your expertise and hearing about your experience in the Faroes. And you will always be the first guest we had on our revamped pod as well. So there's that too.
And I'll never forget it. Thank you.
All right, that will do for part one. We'll be back to talk about some domestic cup action and a trip to Czechia in just a sec. Welcome back to part two of the Sweeper podcast, and we're going to be talking about domestic cup action in this segment, or in the first part of it at least, starting with Liechtenstein, one of our very favourite domestic cups. What have you got for us, Paul?
Well, the Liechtenstein Cup is always a bit of a goldmine for us, and just looking at it this year, and we've got an interesting little quirk. So you'll remember very well, Lee, you went to the final last year. Can you remind us which two teams took part in that?
Yeah, it was FC Bausers against the ever-present FC Vaduz.
Yes, so FC Vaduz, of course, famously always win it. And you saw FC Bausers lose to them last season. So this year, the cup started again. FC Bausers drew FC Vaduz 2 in the first round, so their second team, beat them. And then we're met in the next round by FC Vaduz's third team. And any prizes for guessing who they've got now that they've beaten FC Vaduz 3?
Could it potentially be FC Vaduz?
It's FC Vaduz again in the semi-finals. So I think that's a pretty unique situation that their last four consecutive cup ties will be against the same club, technically.
Yeah, that is interesting. Also, actually, FC Vaduz only just about got there, didn't they? Because we had somebody writing on the Discord the other day about the fact that they were losing in the quarterfinals against Eschen / Mauren. They ended up coming back to win 2-1. But this is, you know, to put this into context, this is a club that hasn't lost a cup tie since 2012.
Yeah, it was nearly another work emergency, wasn't it? Along the lines of a San Marino goal. They really ran that pretty fine, didn't they? And that does mean now that they would, I would say, be very strong favourites to retain the competition yet again. But an interesting cup. We always love the Liechtenstein Cup. We love that there are so few teams and that you have all the reserve teams in there. And again, for everyone probably knows this by now who listens to us, but if you don't, Liechtenstein, the only UEFA country without its own league. So FC Vaduz play in the Swiss system. And this cup win every year is what gets them into Europe.
Yeah, and I think that is quite interesting that the quarterfinals have already taken place in a domestic cup. Bearing in mind the final takes place next May, to have the quarterfinals before the end of October, it's such a weird competition all the way through, like from the fact that you have to have qualifiers so that some of the third teams can book their place in the last 16, because only 16 teams are in the competition proper, and then how spread out it is, how Vaduz always win. It's just utterly bizarre, isn't it?
Yeah, it has the feel of something that would have been made up on the spot, doesn't it? And they've had to stick with it. The semi-finals lineup is brilliant because it's Bausers against Vaduz, which you could say would have made a good final, as it usually does. The other semi-final is Triesenberg against Triesen, is it? Or is it Triesenberg? Triesenberg against Triesen. Fantastic. Look to that one too. You famously have been to all the grounds in Liechtenstein, have you not? So you probably remember those two well.
Yeah, Triesenberg is an incredible ground. So it is up in the hills. It's the only one that's not sort of down somewhere along the Rhine. It's further east in the country, and you have to walk up a hill, big hill, to get there, which I did on that that now infamous hike across Liechtenstein in one day. And when you get up there, it's so hilly that the ground is sort of propped up, like it's not on flat ground basically, because it's built into a hillside. And from there you can look out and you just see for kilometers over the Rhine and into Switzerland. So it's incredible. It won my award for favorite Liechtenstein stadium, whilst at the opposite end of the scale, the Eschen Mauren stadium was surrounded by cowpats, and that was a bit of a perilous walk to get there. So that was my least favorite.
Yeah, you still got a grudge against Eschen Mauren, haven't you? The other day when they nearly beat Vaduz, you were still quite relieved because you just can't stand them because you stood in so many cowpats. It's worth mentioning. Triesenberg versus Triesen, of course. In the round of 16, it was Triesen's second team that Triesenberg played. So this happens throughout the competition because of the structure of it. So Triesenberg beat Triesen 8-0, or Triesen's second team 8-0 in the round of 16. And now they've got them in the semi-finals. So I guess it's just commonplace, this thing of playing versions of a team throughout your cup run when there are only so many teams you can play.
Yeah, I just think to outside ears, it sounds particularly strange that reserve teams are involved. But they are, and we love it. As we do an underdog story in any domestic cup competition, and you've got you've noted down Jeanfield Swifts have accomplished something quite significant.
This was one that I didn't know much about. So Jeanfield Swifts are a lower league Scottish club, and they're from Perth. And they didn't just win in the Scottish Cup and sort of defy the odds to beat Elgin City, who are a league club. They absolutely thrashed them. They beat them 6-0. So this is Scottish Cup second round, and it's the biggest, I think it's the biggest sort of second round shock or the biggest defeat of this type for a really, really long time. So it said, you know, Elgin City are a bottom of the fourth tier. So they're really struggling. But Genefield, non-league team, beat them, 6-0, which is not just a cup shock, it's a cup annihilation, isn't it, really?
Yeah, I've got here the biggest victory for a non-league team in the competition since 1896. Do we know what happened 127 years ago?
Oh, I did read this. I think it was an 8-1, one of our favourite types of scoring. It's something like an 8-1. But, and this is where you really have to bury down, somebody online was saying that shouldn't really technically have counted. I can't remember exactly why, but it might be something to do with the fact it was so long ago that there was something sort of about the way the league was structured that it doesn't quite count the same way. But basically, it's 100 years in the making, a result like this. As much as you're happy for Genefield Swifts, I imagine that's put a significant amount of pressure on Elgin City. Being bottom of the league, you think, oh, good, it's a cup week. And then you lose 6-0.
Yeah, I imagine so. More cup updates from around Europe. There was a big one in Slovakia last week, a big result. That was Lokomotiva Devinska Nova Ves, who play in the fifth division of Slovak football. They knocked out Trencin, who up until recently were the top flight leaders. Now that is a cup set of incredible proportions.
Yeah, that's a biggie. That's a really biggie. Mm. You tend to see them often when clubs are struggling in the league, is that they see the cup and then they get battered. But yeah, if you're that dominant, that's a rare one.
And do you know who the goalkeeper was for Trencin that day?
Is it the guy we featured before? Did we feature someone whose son was also on the pitch with him at the same time or something?
Yeah, this was the son. So this was the story that we had a few pods ago about the father whose final game of his career in goal was against his son, who was in the opposite goal. And his son, Michael Kukushka, was in goal for Trencin in this game. So imagine that. You are giving your dad lots of banter about the fact that you knocked him out of the cup. And then the next game, the next round, you're knocked out by a team in the fifth division.
Yeah, I bet that was a feisty one in there at the family meals. I love stories like that.
Some other domestic cup news. We have seventh tier Deportivo Murcia, the first Spanish club in the 120-year history of the Copa del Rey to win a game whilst in the seventh division. They are at home to La Liga team Alaves on Thursday, the 2nd of November. So that's one we'll be keeping our eyes on closely. And Paul, just yesterday at the time of recording, La Tamponese won their game in Réunion, which means that they will be taking part in the Coupe de France again. What about that?
Oh, that's fantastic news. They were competing against another team from Réunion, though. Were they at that stage? It's their playoffs to be the one that go to France, was it?
Yeah, exactly. So two teams from Réunion qualify for the Coupe de France. So there were four teams playing in these two playoff matches, and La Tamponese were one of the winners. So we can look forward to seeing them. The stage at which they enter the competition, I think, will be at some point in November. So that will be one of those big 10,000 kilometer round trips.
And you know full well what we can look forward to, Lee, which is us posting a series of very thoughtful tweets about the club and their history and this amazing achievement, and getting about 15 responses that are just tampon every year. You can set your watch by it.
We can look forward to that very soon for sure. The next thing we're going to talk about in this podcast is something that we briefly discussed on our last Patreon bonus pod. That was the Czech team that lost 9-5, FC Zlin, who were beaten 9-5 by Mladá Boleslav just a week ago. And I decided that I would go and see just how bad they are. So with producer Tom and our friend Simon Clark, who makes the other Bundesliga podcast, we got the bus from Vienna to the Czech town of Olomouc on Saturday to see this terrible club, Zlin, play against Sigma Olomouc. And can you guess what the score was, by any chance?
Not only could I guess what the score was, when you texted me to say what you were planning, I told you what the score was going to be, and it was...
0-0.
You cannot tempt fate more than saying, we're going to travel to a game to see how bad this team that have just conceded nine are. Nothing makes a team more defensively solid than reading that.
Yeah, but the thing is, they were actually defensively not bad, and that's what really confused me, because how do you let in 8 second half goals and then put in a performance like that? And there were, granted, some sort of hearts and mouths moments in that game. I think Sigma Olomouc hit the crossbar once and the post twice, so it wasn't as if, you know, they had no chances. But apart from those incidents, Zlin did not look like a team short on confidence, did not look like a team without defensive structure. So basically, they just ruined my day out.
Well, I can only imagine they were all motivated by pinning up your tweets in the dressing room. Yeah. They're all just out there saying, this guy has come to see us destroyed. All right, let's see what we can do about that. Yeah, I bet it was. If I was a manager and I saw your tweet, I'd think, right, all right, let's see what we can do about this.
We did have some fun with it, though, because you actually sent me a message on WhatsApp to say, hope the game is good today, but we both know it's a nailed on 0-0. And I read that out, and producer Tom decided that he would put a €1.50 bet on Zlin to draw 0-0 in Olomouc, and the odds were around 10-1. And that actually gave us quite a lot of entertainment in the closing stages, as Sigma Olomouc sort of came forward wave after wave of attack in those final minutes. And we were sort of thinking, do we cash out? Because, you know, betting companies, they have this really annoying cash out function now, and it really plays with your mind. So I had to, like, I was next to Tom and I was like, no, don't cash out, because if we win €17, that is a significant number of Czech beers. And so it proved to be. We did have a significant number of Czech beers.
That's amazing. Well, I feel like I've added something then to your experience. I didn't just sneer at you. I also allowed you to have a lot of Czech beers to the point where you assumed you had seen some goals, I imagine.
And the best piece of football stadium food that I've ever had in my life. So there was that. We saw, you know, Footy Scran on Twitter that has these sort of pictures of, you know, food and drink from stadiums around the world. Well, we saw that they, at Sigma Olomouc, they had a hog roast a few weeks back. And we were thinking, it's literally like a full pig over a fire. And we were thinking, wow, are they going to be doing that? So we went outside the stadium looking for food. Now, there was no hog roast, but after the game, we bumped into two guys who had their own food stand and they weren't getting much custom. So we went over to have a chat to them. And they said, go on, just try some of this. And I think part of us felt a little bit sorry for them that they just had all this food and they weren't selling any of it. And so what we ended up having was, it was some kind of pulled pork with spätzle, which is a kind of egg noodle, gravy on it and crispy onions. And honestly, it was incredible. It was so nice. So if you're ever in Olomouc for a game, go to the guys behind the stadium and get yourself, I don't even know what it's called, but it was sensational.
I love that tip as well. We're one of the few podcasts where if you say, if you're ever in Olomouc for a game, genuinely you might get a few people go, oh, okay, I'll note that.
One final thing that I wanted to add on this story was that this was my very first Czech game ever. But 10 years ago, I thought that I was going to see a Czech game and ended up getting the worst birthday surprise of my life. So I was doing an Interrail trip with an English friend of mine, and we went up to visit a Czech friend of mine in, I think, Přerov is the name of her hometown. And she told me, because it was around my birthday time, she said, Lee, there's a surprise for you on your birthday. So I thought, well, she mentioned that we might go to Ostrava. It's going to be a weekend. Maybe I'm going to see a Banik Ostrava game. And so, you know, I had high hopes and I thought, well, maybe if it's not a game, we'll do a stadium tour or something. We got to Ostrava and she told me that it was an industrial town famous for its concrete production, and that the birthday surprise was that we would be going to the local concrete factory for a tour. But it got worse, because me and Pete, we had these helmets on, we're on this sort of, you know, it's building site type place, walking around this concrete factory. And I said to my friend Misha, will there be an English translation? And she said, no, there's no English translation, but I will translate for you. And I was thinking, concrete production, how is she going to do that? So the tour guide opened her mouth, said about two or three sentences. I turned to Misha for the translation and she just said, no, it's too complicated. I can't translate that. So...
So you just had to, you had to believe in the universal language of concrete, right?
We just ended up two Englishmen walking around a Czech concrete production factory with builders' helmets on for 2 hours, not knowing what the hell was going on.
That's amazing. That has got to be down there with the most disappointing days out ever, yeah. Isn't it? I wonder if anyone else ever listening has had a disappointing football non-event. You know, have you ever been somewhere thinking you're about to witness something football related and had to have a different language tour of a concrete factory? I can't see it being beaten.
I'm sure we've got a fair few listeners now. I'm sure one of them will have a similar or worse story. So if you've got one, send it in to us at sweeperpod@gmail.com. And on that note, if you want to hear about any more of my personal traumas, including the time I slept in a Romanian lorry in Calais, you should join our Patreon. Because, there's also some serious content on there, isn't there, Paul?
Yeah, yeah. But I can only really think about that time you went on that lorry and what happened. God.
Well, the serious content does include bonus podcasts, which we make every fortnight. We also give our patrons a sneak peek into our stories for each pod. And we give away a mystery shirt box from our partner, Surprise Shirts. This one in October was won by patron Mike Laybourne. So congratulations to you, Mike. That will be on its way to you very soon. And we also write some blog posts, don't we, Paul? We've written some good ones recently.
Yeah, well, yeah, I loved your Salzburg Derby one. That was a brilliant one. And I am very steadily working my way through the Up Pompeii sequel, which I am due to get to very soon. So yeah, you get all this on our Patreon. You don't get it anywhere else.
No. And you can sign up at patreon.com/sweeperpod. It's only £5 a month. And that gives us recurring, stable monthly revenue that we can invest back into the show, cover our editing software costs, get more guests on, and devote more time to expanding our range of content. You can also actually now, it's a new feature, you can sign up for free and get short previews of our bonus episodes to find out if you like it. So if you do enjoy the free pods, give it a go. That's patreon.com/sweeperpod. Time for a break now, though. We'll be back in just a second for a non-European roundup. Welcome back to part three of the Sweeper podcast, and it's time to give the rest of the world some loving. And we're going to start off in Tonga, of all places, where a perfect season has been achieved.
It has. Now, there's a slight caveat here in that it's only a 14-game season. And I started to look at this. We have, obviously, early in the season, we massively jinxed Faroe's team, KR Klaksvik, by saying that they were going to get to a perfect season when they didn't actually get that close. But Navutoka in the Tonga Major League have managed a perfect season, 14 wins out of 14. There's a slight extra bit now. They have a playoff semi-final and then a final to win the actual trophy. They won the playoff semi-final very easily at the weekend, so they're in the final. And if they did win that, that would be 16 wins out of 16, and that's as good as you can do. We'll leave it up to the rest of the world to debate whether 16 games is enough to really be considered, you know, for the perfect season sort of annals of history. The last one of those, I think, was in 1995, and it was a team from Mauritius, I think. Am I right? Or Seychelles, one of them.
Although we have had it pointed out to us on Twitter that there was a case of this much more recently in Macau. So Chow Pak K in Macau won 16 games out of 16 in 2022, 95 goals for, 4 against. So I feel like us saying that it was Sunrise Flak United of Mauritius may have actually been due to an erroneous source.
Yes, named Wikipedia.
Yes, named Wikipedia.
Yeah.
The perfect seasons article on Wikipedia is wrong, basically, is what I was trying to say. But do tell us what I think is the most interesting element of the Navutoka success story.
They had this article about the team and it was all pretty normal, got some great young players coming through. It then said they've also got some more experienced players, including 2 62-year-olds. And if you do look, we did a tweet about this. If you look at the photo of one of the starting 11s, there is very clearly, there are two players who clearly look quite a bit older, but one of them is looking very good for 62. And one of them, with the greatest respect to him, looks every bit 62.
Yeah,
quite an achievement, though, really, to have two players of that age still competing at what is the top level in Tonga.
Yeah, absolutely. There is also another club that got very close to doing it this year. That is the dominant force in Malaysia, Johor Darul Tazim, who currently have 25 wins and one draw. So that's a pretty good effort, but you'd be gutted for that one draw, wouldn't you?
You really would, wouldn't you? You really would. And I think, I actually think what cost Ker Klaksvik was the European ties. I think they were a lot less interested in the perfect season than we were, because obviously if you've got anything else to play for, and the title's more or less wrapped up, you do start to rest players, because a perfect season isn't actually a thing that the fans really massively care about. But for nerds like us, it's a big deal.
It's a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's finish off with our next Asian story then, the two away fans in Thailand, and then I'll take us over to South America.
Yeah, and we again, another thing that we've consistently enjoyed is hearing tales of people who've made crazy away days. And I got this one from Twitter, and it was from Taleo, so at T-A-L-A-O underscore, pointed out that Thai League 2 club Suphanburi had just two fans who travelled over 850 kilometres to watch their game against Krabi, which they won 1-0. So there's this lovely photo of the players coming over to applaud these two fans. And obviously the players massively outnumber their away support.
I wonder, by the way, if they stopped off in McDonald's for some food and bumped into the Thai national team.
As is the tradition, yes. I also, we always have this, I would like to see evidence that they have travelled the 850 kilometres. I'm always cynical now. You know, what happens if they just happen to live in Krabi, you know? But I hope they did the due diligence. I trust Talao, because his content was always very good.
All right, then. Final story for today is from Ecuador. This is the case of a 27-year-old coach called Joe Armas. And I think this is a brilliant example of what you can do if you show total dedication and put your mind 100% to something. So he always dreamed of being a manager, and he went to Europe, completed internships with some really big clubs, Real Madrid, Ajax, PSV. And at the same time, he financed the whole operation by working as a bricklayer on a construction site. After which, he returned to his home country of Ecuador and sent his CV out to more than 300 football clubs, hoping that he would get a managerial role. He even offered to work for free. When he didn't have any luck in Ecuador, he sent his resume out to clubs in Guatemala too. And no response whatsoever until 2021, when a team in the third division called Imbabura offered him the job. And that same year, he guided them to promotion to Serie B. The following year, they made it to the quarterfinals of the Copa Ecuador and beat Liga de Quito, who are one of the biggest clubs in Ecuadorian football along the way. And now, very recently, just a few days ago, Imbabura defeated Macara 4-0 to finish up runners-up in Serie B and earn a place in the top flight, all under a manager who is 27 years old.
That's amazing. What a lovely story. Because I do think, you know, it's a big theme in football that it's such a closed shop for jobs, isn't it? And you do kind of wonder, if you're a talented, driven enough person, how do you even get that breakthrough? So there you go. That's what you have to do. You have to message 300 clubs in Ecuador. That's what we're advising our listeners to do.
I think it always comes with a lot of skepticism, doesn't it, when clubs appoint very young managers? Because I remember back in the day when Julian Nagelsmann was appointed as the Hoffenheim manager at the age of 28. And everybody was just like, what are they doing? This is mad. But if somebody's good enough, it doesn't matter how old they are. Does it?
No, it doesn't. Although it is a very interesting dynamic when you are coaching someone who is older than you. And I think it must be very hard to command respect if you've not been a successful player yourself and you're younger. I imagine there's a lot of dressing rooms you go into as a 28-year-old who doesn't have a playing CV, you know, stratospheric early career to back them up. You'd be looked at with a lot of suspicion, wouldn't you? I think that's probably what's really hard to do when you're 27, 28 is command the respect of a 35-year-old who's been playing since they were, you know, same in any other workplace. If you were suddenly managed by someone who's much younger than you and you don't really feel has ever done your job, you'd probably be pretty cynical about it.
What about other young football managers that have defied the odds and done a great job? What about that young Paul Watson at the Federated States of Micronesia?
Yeah, well, I've just been complaining to people. Once again, I'm going to be overlooked for the Bristol City job. You know, I'm a Bristol City fan, always have been. And I find it an insult that I'm seeing people like Frank Lampard linked to the job when to my knowledge, he's never managed international football team at all. So it's shocking, really.
Talking of international, we asked our listeners on the last episode if they could get in contact with us if they've listened to the pod in multiple different countries. And we have had a few people write in. The first one of those being Dimitris Ballas on Twitter. He says he's Greek, but in the last 100 days, he's listened to the pod from Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, and recently Tajikistan. By the way, I watched Afghanistan versus Mongolia in Dushanbe, which would have been, I think, the first leg of that World Cup qualifier that you didn't get to the second leg of, right?
It was indeed, yeah. They had to play it in Tajikistan because Afghanistan can't play at home. So they were hosting it there. I'm very jealous of that. But I'm also incredibly thankful to Demetrius for making it look like we've got a huge following in the stands, like in Central Asia.
Yeah.
We're big in Central Asia and it's all just one person. I love that.
We got another one from Joe McTaggart, didn't we?
Yeah. So Joe McTaggart says, regarding listeners in multiple countries, I'm a student in Aberdeen studying German, Spanish and Latin American studies, but on the Euroboard in Santiago. So listening from Santiago to Compostela, and cheering on the local team, SD Compostela, who have just appointed a new manager and got a tasty draw at home to Tenerife in the cup. But we'll also be in Germany in April to cheer on the local team, Eichstätt, and of course, Scotland in the Euros. So yeah, thanks, Joe. You're running up some numbers for us again. Really appreciate that. And very jealous that you're listening from Santiago to Compostela.
Random fact about Eichstätt, that is, I think, I did a thread a while back on Twitter about the lower league teams that have done very well in European Cup competitions. So this was mostly from the Cup Winners Cup era when they could qualify by winning the domestic cup while outside of the top tier. And I think that if you exclude Welsh clubs and clubs from Liechtenstein, Eichstätt were one of the very first third division clubs to play European football. This was back at the start of the 90s, but that's all I know about them.
It's a great fact.
Thanks, Paul. The final message that we got from a listener is from Thomas Herbert on Twitter. He said, listen to the last pod here at a coffee shop in the cricket stadium in Colombo, Sri Lanka, and then posted a picture as evidence of himself listening to the pod on his smartwatch. So that's Sri Lanka as
well. Fantastic.
Yeah,
we're running up the numbers now. Can't stress this enough. I'd like there to be someone in every single country that's listened to us. So yeah, if you are going anywhere weird, just put our podcast on. It'll make us happy.
Yeah, certainly will. I think that's just about it for today's episode. But if you do join the Patreon, then the next episode, you will hear Paul and I recording together in person for the very first time. So that's to look forward to. That episode will be out on Wednesday, the 8th of November. So that's www.patreon.com/sweeperpod. But that's it for today. We'll leave it there and we'll be back with another main pod on Wednesday, the 15th of November.